Who was that woman?
An old friend of the family who was in need. I was happy to help. I wish you'd let me help you. That you had come to me when those traitors tried to manipulate you.
Perhaps if you had been there, I might have been more comfortable going to you.
It's so good to hear you say that. I know now the judge made the right decision. It's time to get on with your life. Have you thought about how you might give back to the Reich? Nurses are always in demand, especially with our brave troops on the front, getting wounded every day in Russia.
I had that thought. I only got out of jail 3 weeks ago, however. I need a little time. Perhaps when Christmas is over.
I understand. Where will you be spending Christmas?
Munich. That's where my life is now. I'm only back for a few days.
Yet you have your skis with you, he said, as he glanced to the floor beside the table. Suddenly she became aware of the morphine in her backpack, the gauze, and the plaster of Paris. If he searched it, this would all end.
My father's apartment was destroyed in the mine raid. I'm staying in our old summer house in the mountains. I can't say I expected to get snowed in, however.
Yes, this weather has been quite something. But you say that you intend to make your way back to Munich for Christmas. That's just 9 days away.
That's my plan. I don't want to spend Christmas alone in that old cabin. I want to get back to Munich as soon as I can.
I remember that cabin. We had some good times there.
Franca tried not to shudder as she remembered weekends spent in her father's cabin with him. Those college days, when he was the dashing local Hitler Youth leader, seemed like eons ago. Most of the other girls had been jealous. They could have him now. She noticed a wedding ring on his finger.
So, you're married?
Yes, for 4 years now. You remember Helga Dagover?
Of course.
We have two sons, Bastian and Jürgen.
Many congratulations.
Yes, they are fine Aryan boys, just what this country needs. Of course, by the time they're grown, this war will be over, and they'll be able to reap the benefits of what we're trying to sow.
Franka didn't answer. The desire to run, to escape, was almost beyond her control, and it took every fragment of strength within her to sit still.
Would you like to see a picture of them?
Of course.
Beckel reached into his pocket and removed his wallet. A proud smile cracked across his face as he drew out the photograph, and his eyes lit up in a way she hadn't thought possible. Are they not the most beautiful boys in the world?
Yes.
I do love them so. The worst part of my job is that I'm away from them so much, but they're always in my heart.
He returned the photo to his wallet. He reached into his pocket and pulled out a silver-plated cigarette case. Franca noticed the initials on it weren't his. He offered one to her once more, but she refused. It had been years since she had smoked, and the previous cigarette had added to the nausea spreading through her like scum across a stagnant pond. Beckel lit the cigarette and sat back. The man in the cabin emerged in her mind.
You never married, Franca?
No, I never did.
What age are you now? 26? You have so much to offer. You don't want to end up an old maid, do you? Your childbearing days are slipping by. You won't see the flower of your youth again once it's gone, you know.
I'm aware of my age, Daniel.
I don't mean it like that. I didn't mean to cause any offense. You're more beautiful now than ever.
That's quite all right, Daniel. And thank you again,
she said, unable to keep eye contact for more than a few seconds.
You were quite the catch in your teenage years.
He sat back in his wooden chair and clasped his hands behind his head.
Oh, yes, I remember well. All the other boys were jealous of me. I had the most beautiful girl in all of Freiburg. I felt like the luckiest boy alive. What happened to us? You never explained. You just dropped me.
I saw who you really were. I realized whom they'd turned you into.
She wondered whether he was being deliberately ignorant, if this was some ploy to test her loyalties, or if he truly didn't know. Had he not figured it out by now? They had broken up in 1936 when she was 19. He had tried to get back with her after that, and while she was adamant about not being his girlfriend, she was careful not to push him too far away. She was fearful of his growing power and influence as a member of the local Gestapo. On Kristallnacht, in 1938, he had joined with the mobs, when the streets of Freiburg and every other town and city in Germany glistened with broken glass from the windows and storefronts of Jewish-owned businesses, when the night sky burned red from the flames of burning synagogues. Thousands died in a state-sponsored nationwide riot against Jewish Germans, and Daniel Berkel was one of the leaders of the marauding pack of dogs dragging Jewish business owners onto the streets to be kicked and beaten. That night opened her eyes to what the Nazis were really trying to achieve in Germany. She felt changed. Much of the reason she left Freiburg was to get away from him. She abandoned Freddy to get away from him.
That's ancient history now. Why mire ourselves in the past, when the German people have such a sparkling future to look forward to?
He smiled, but his eyes darkened. He took another drag on the cigarette before speaking again. You've something to hide. Why not tell, so we can put the past behind us and go on as friends from here? If you're going to be living in Freiburg...
I'm not going to be in Freiburg. I'm moving back to Munich in the next few days, as soon as the road's clear.
Bechel took another drag from the cigarette just as the waitress came over. He ordered a beer, and Franca felt her insides tighten. So you found someone else?
It wasn't that. We grew apart. We were just children then.
Many of the men I work with, good, loyal men, dedicated to the betterment of this country and the protection of the Reich, were married by that age. Some had children earlier than that.
That wasn't to be for us.
The waitress came back with his beer and told him it was on the house, as it always was for the Gestapo. He didn't thank her, just leaned forward to stare at Franca again. So I read that you were involved with the head of those traitors in Munich. Was he to be the father of your children? Hans's name felt sullied by Berkel mentioning it. She brought her hands under the table, balling them into fists so tight she almost drew blood.
That part of my life is over now.
She fought back the tears. She wasn't going to cry in front of him. She'd rather die than cry in front of him. You were lucky. You should thank the Gestapo agents that caught him and the others. You should thank the executioner, too. They did you the greatest favor the government could ever do for a person. They set you free. They set you free from the madness of the ideas those criminals were preaching. And they even had the mercy and the magnanimity to spare your life. Each word hurt. Was she meant to be grateful to that judge for sparing her life? She'd wished so many times since for the opposite. It sickens me to think that such people exist. He said the word people as if it were a curse word. But it's heartening to know that they received the swift justice they deserved, and that further innocents were protected from their vile influence.
They did what they thought was best for the German people,
she said. Her voice was so low that she barely heard herself. He shook his head and took a generous mouthful of beer. Naive fools! Were they trying to take us back to the days of mass unemployment and social disorder in the streets? Democracy was the biggest calamity ever cast upon this country. The Führer rescued us from the curse of Versailles, delivered us from the November criminals, and has cemented our place among the greatest nations in the world again. Franco wanted to ask why he wasn't fighting on the front if he was so committed to the cause. The Gestapo didn't operate under any rule of law. He could bring her downtown to Gestapo headquarters right now, and she might never be seen again. No one would ask questions. she'd be one more disappeared enemy of the state. Her life depended entirely on the whim of this man whose heart she'd once broken.
You're right. I was misled. I'm grateful I was spared. The leaders pressured me into attending meetings. They made it seem like it was the patriotic thing to do.
When it was the opposite. I'm glad to see that you never fell completely under their spell. It's heartening to know that you have a second chance to make up for your mistakes.
It was a pleasure catching up with you, Daniel, but I really should be going. I have to get back to the cabin before nightfall.
He stared across the table at her for a few seconds before he answered.
Of course. It would be a most hazardous journey in the dark of night. I wouldn't want to be responsible for holding you up.
Quite, Daniel, if you'll excuse me,
she said as she stood up. He didn't move, just glared at her from his seat.
But wait, the roads up there are snowbound, are they not? That's why you have your skis with you.
Yes, so I really should get going.
How did you intend to get back? You can hardly ski 10 miles back up there.
I have that all taken care of.
How? You can't have a car with you. It must be stuck up in the snow, at the cabin.
It is, but...
So how are you planning to get back?
I have someone waiting to give me a ride.
Who? You don't know anyone here anymore. And after your time in jail, you can't have the best reputation.
Well, I was going to...
Hitch a ride? Nonsense. I will take you.
Franco felt her heart jump.
No, I couldn't possibly inconvenience you. That would take more than an hour away from your busy schedule.
I'm on my lunch. I can make up the time later.
His eyes were boring a hole through her. She went to answer, but it was no good. He stood up.
All right, then. It's settled. I have a car outside. Are you ready to go now?
I just need to pay the bill.
Leave the money on the table.
Franca threw down a few crumpled notes. Beckel didn't say another word as he led her out of the cafe. A black Mercedes sat outside, and he opened the back door for her to squeeze her skis and poles in. She kept the backpack with her, putting it at her feet as she sat in the passenger seat.
Just keep your mouth shut. Agree with whatever he says.
They spoke about people they'd known, and old times, as they drove through the city. Franco wondered whether he was investigating her, or genuinely under some illusion that they were old friends. Perhaps it was neither. Perhaps it was both. Or perhaps it was something else. Franco still had to present her papers to the guard at the checkpoint. Bethel greeted him with a lazy salute, underscoring the fact that he was a superior officer. She waited until they were out of the city and on the highway to ask her question.
What are your boys like?
Wonderful. Just wonderful. They're the most beautiful things I've ever seen. They're strong young Aryans, too. We're proud of them. Jürgen is just 3, and he can already sing Deutschland über alles.
Franco went silent as Beckel told her about his sons. It gave her pause, but soon he was back preaching about the greatness of the Reich and the genius of Hitler. The minutes dragged out agonizingly. The place where he needed to drop her off came and looked like an oasis.
I'd appreciate it if you let me out here, Daniel. You've been so kind. Lesser men would have held what I did against me forever. I've made mistakes, but I'm determined to live the best life I can from here.
Beckel pulled the car over to the side of the road and turned to her.
It is my job to be suspicious at all times, Franca, and I remain so. It was fantastic to see you, but you are not just an old friend to me. You are a convicted enemy of the state. And while I think that almost every Aryan deserves a second chance, you will need to prove your loyalty to the Reich and to our beloved Führer. I hope that we will never meet in an official capacity. But know that I am watching you.
As I said, I'm moving back to Munich within days.
And if that is the case, I wish you good luck, and I'll say
Heil Hitler.
Heil Hitler,
Franka said. Her voice was weak. She put the backpack on. He got out to help her with her skis and handed them to her.
I enjoyed seeing you, Franka. I hope you find the peace you're searching for. Be careful who you mix with.
She nodded, and he got back into the car. She stood still as the car left. She felt violated, reviled, disgusted. The cabin no longer felt safe, or free from the Nazi regime she despised more than ever. With little daylight left, she had not the time to stand at the side of the road analyzing their conversation, and she was glad of that. She slipped on the skis again, and started up the trail toward the cabin. Surely the fact that she'd told him that she was moving back to Munich would prevent any intrusions by the Gestapo. But what if they were looking for the man? Someone could have seen his parachute. The journey back up the hill, with the provisions on her back weighing her down, was far more difficult than the way down, and she had to stop halfway for a rest. The light of day was shrinking to nothing, the air darkening by the moment as the cabin finally came into view. Flakes of snow meandered down. The bedroom window was unlit. Franka wondered if the man was asleep. Would he finally begin to trust her now that she'd gone all the way into town on his behalf? How much longer was the Werner Graf charade going to last? How could she trust him when she knew he was lying to her about who he was? She took off her skis as she reached the front door and shook them off before resting them against the house. The door opened with a creak. The light of the fire colored the living room walls orange and yellow, and she wondered how the man had stocked the fireplace with wood. When she saw him, he was sitting in the rocking chair by the fire, her father's pistol in his hand, the barrel pointed at her. Chapter 5. Franka let the rucksack slip from her shoulder and let it fall to the floor. The man stared at her and had the gun pointed at her chest. His eyes twitched in the half-light, his teeth gritted in pain. She cursed herself for not hiding the gun better. It was hard to imagine how he'd gotten out of bed, let alone made it all the way to the table by the front door.
How did you get out of your room?
I'm asking the questions here. She saw his finger tense on the trigger.
I have your painkillers. You must be in terrible discomfort. I have food, too. Enough for both of us for days.
I asked you a question. Why am I here? Why did you bring me back to this cabin? His ingratitude was vexing her, and she felt her temper, blunt as it usually was, beginning to rise. He was terrified, a stranger in a hostile land. She was thankful he hadn't pulled the trigger as soon as she'd walked through the door.
Simple necessity. It was too far to the nearest hospital, and I had no way of getting you there.
Have you told anyone else that I'm here?
No.
Why not?
Because you asked me not to. You said even the local authorities knowing you were here might compromise your mission.
He stared on, the gun still pointed at her. He didn't seem to know what to say next.
I told you. My name is Franka Gerber. I'm from Freiburg, and this was my parents' summer cabin. They're both dead now. My father died just a few months ago in a bombing raid on the city. My mother died 8 years ago, of cancer.
She thought to tell him about Freddy, but realized that she wouldn't be able to without breaking down. She was close enough to that already.
I brought you back here because you needed help. You would have died out there. It is an absolute miracle I found you. There is no one else around here for miles.
Why are you keeping me here? His voice quivered as he spoke, perhaps from the pain he was in, perhaps from something else. She stared at the barrel of the gun.
Because I have no other choice. The roads are closed. I can't get you down to the main road. It's just not possible with your broken legs.
She pointed at the bag.
I have plaster of Paris, gauze, and everything else I need to set them in casts. I can do this for you if you let me. But I need you to trust me.
How do I know you're not an Allied agent, keeping me here to win over my trust?
I'm not an Allied agent. I'm just a nurse from Freiburg.
The man let the gun drop a few inches before raising it up again.
I'm going to take off my hat and gloves now,
Franka said. He nodded, and she did as she said, letting them fall to the ground. She inched toward him with her hands out, as if approaching a frightened dog.
You have nothing to fear. I'm not working for anyone. I don't have an agenda.
What are you planning to do with me?
I want to see you walk out of here. I don't want you to tell me about your mission. You don't have to talk. I just need you to trust me and know that I don't mean you any harm.
Franka tried to hide it, but her voice was shaking. She motioned toward the chair beside her. He didn't refuse, so she sat down.
Who are you going to turn me over to?
He raised his hand to cough, never letting the gun waver from her.
I'm not planning to turn you over to anyone. Not unless you want me to.
There's no phone here. No one for miles around.
We're alone. You can shoot me now, but you'd be killing yourself too. It's snowing again. We could be here for weeks. You won't be able to travel, and you'll die here. You need to trust me. I don't mean you any harm.
Can you take me into the city?
No. You'd never make it. I barely made it myself, and I know these trails. I've been coming here my whole life. You need to realize that we're stuck with each other for a while. We need to trust one another. I must say I'm finding it difficult to trust you with that gun pointed at me.
You had no right to take my guns from me in the first place.
It was a precaution, nothing more. You had no need for them.
How do I know that?
Because if I wanted you dead, I'd have left you out in the snow. You were hours from death when I found you.
She could see his eyes yielding, perhaps to logic, or perhaps to necessity. The man lowered the gun a few inches and closed his eyes for a second.
How do I know you're telling me the truth about any of this?
If I was some kind of Allied agent, how on earth would I have known you were going to land in the snow, in the middle of nowhere, in Germany? Why would I be here in the mountains waiting for you to drop out of the sky? Your theory is someone found you when you were unconscious and deposited you here to be snared by a woman.
He closed his eyes but didn't speak.
Who else is here other than the Gestapo? The Gestapo doesn't deal in subtlety and nuance. They don't try to coax information out of their victims. If I were Gestapo, I'd be torturing you right now.
Why on earth would I be afraid of the Gestapo?
Well then, why won't you let me report you to them?
The man opened his eyes and opened his mouth to speak, but she didn't let him.
I can help you. I want to help you. I went all the way into Freiburg today for you. I could have gone to a village closer to here, but they wouldn't have had the painkillers you need. Put the gun down and let me help you. And then, when the roads open, I'll deliver you to the local authorities, and you can resume your recovery in a Luftwaffe hospital.
The man looked at the ground and put the gun in his lap. His voice was weak, drained of life.
Why are you doing this, homie?
Because I'm a nurse. Because you needed help. Because I needed to be valuable again. I needed to do something useful. Something good.
You don't need to deliver me to the authorities. I can look after myself.
Whatever you wish, Herr Graf. I really don't care. Think of this as a recovery ward in a hospital. I'm here to do a job. And once you're gone, I'm no longer responsible. Does that sound fair?
Yes, it does. Thank you, Fräulein.
His body drooped. The color had drained from his face.
You're welcome. You must be half-starved. Have you had anything to eat?
I didn't make it to the kitchen.
You wouldn't have found much in there.
Franca let out a deep breath. She still didn't know who he was, but that conversation could wait. Right now, she needed to be a nurse again, and that felt good. She reached into the bag and removed a small bottle of morphine. He didn't speak as she drew out the syringe and filled it full of the clear liquid.
This will help you with the worst of the pain. I have enough for the next 3 days or so, and then you'll be back to aspirin. You might feel dizzy, faint, or drowsy, and we'll keep a bucket for your vomit, but you'll be spending the next few days in bed anyway. There's no reason for you to be out here.
I understand.
You're not my prisoner,
Franca said, as she flicked the barrel of the syringe with her fingernail.
I'm a friend. You'll come to see that in time. You're free to go as soon as the road's open, or you can stay a little longer, should you wish to continue your recovery here.
Thank you.
Now, how are we going to get you back into that bed?
I crawled out here. I can crawl back in.
And how exactly do you suggest crawling back into the bed? You won't be able to haul yourself up.
I can manage it.
I have a better idea.
Franca went around behind him and tilted the rocking chair backward so that his legs were off the ground. He stifled the pain, biting down on his fist. She put a hand on his shoulder.
I'm sorry. I need to get you back into the bed first, and then I'll give you the painkillers.
It's just a little discomfort. I'm fine.
Franca took her hand off the man's shoulder and pushed the rocking chair. He kept the gun on his lap. She didn't reach for it or even ask for it back. Pushing him proved harder than she'd anticipated, and progress back to the window was slow. Thankfully, it was only 20 feet away, and after a few aborted attempts, they arrived at the bed. The man tried to haul himself up, his thick arms struggling with his weight until she reached under his armpits, helping him up and over. He reached back for the pistol and shoved it under his pillow. Best to let him keep it, to show him that she trusted him, that she wasn't the enemy. He lay back, the pain he was trying to hide etched on his face. He was sweating, panting, and she left to get him a glass of water before coming back and administering the drugs.
It will take about 20 minutes for the drugs to start working, and then I'll set your cast tomorrow morning. In the meantime, I'll get you something to eat before any nausea sets in.
The man nodded. She smiled at him before going back to the kitchen and returning with a plate of fresh bread and cheese. He ate it in seconds and collapsed back onto the pillow. It was after 7 o'clock.
I'm going to leave you now. Try to relax and get a good night's sleep. We'll talk tomorrow. I'll be the one asking the questions then.
The man closed his eyes, the drug-induced euphoria kicking in. A tiny smile came across his face.
Good night, Fräulein, he whispered.
She covered him with a thick layer of blankets, extinguished the oil lamp, and shut the door behind her as she left. He'd picked the lock once. Locking the door would be useless now. She would have to trust him, because she knew he wasn't giving up her father's gun. The fatigue she'd denied all day came to bear, and she shuffled into the kitchen to get some ham and bread. As much as she wanted to go to bed, she knew that the fire wouldn't last the night, and the supply of wood was getting perilously low. She finished her meager meal, and after summoning the energy, she put on her hat, coat, and gloves, and ventured back outside. Fortunately, there was just enough chopped wood remaining on the back porch to get them through the night. She would need to get more tomorrow. It was up to her. Everything would be. Daniel Berchel haunted her thoughts as she lay in bed. His ice-blue eyes were the last thing she saw before she finally succumbed to sleep. The house was cold when she woke. The fires had died overnight, and the air in the cabin was bordering on glacial. The mountainous layer of blankets on her bed was the only sanctuary, but she knew it was a temporary one. Hunger and her desire to check on the man drove her feet onto the floor. Her coat was hanging by the bed, and she put it on over her nightdress before emerging from her bedroom. With no sign of life from the other bedroom, she made herself a breakfast of liverwurst, bread, and cheese. The snow had come in earnest again last night, and the car was almost invisible now. Her footprints would be covered at least, and with the roads closed for a few more days, the man would have some time to recover from the worst of his pain. The extra layers of snow outside would also offer some protection against any unwanted visits from Birkel. Perhaps by the time the snow had melted and the roads were passable, he would assume that she'd moved back to Munich. Wishful thinking. The Gestapo never assumed anything. She would need to finish that hiding place under the floorboards as soon as possible. Franco went to the man, pushing his bedroom door open with two fingers. He was still asleep, lying on his back, snoring.
"You sleep, whoever you are,"
she whispered.
"That's the best thing for you."
She stayed in the doorway for another minute or two, listening to the sound of him breathing, hoping to hear him say something in English again to cement her convictions. He didn't say a word in English or German. She left him. The matter of warming the cabin was more pressing. The snow was 3 feet deep beyond the back porch. She took the sled and dragged it into the woods, axe in hand. Her father had taught her these things when she was a child. He hadn't loved her any less because she was a girl, but hadn't babied her either. He taught her how to gather wood, season it, and set the fire. He taught her how to shoot, set traps, and skin and prepare the kill. He'd also introduced her to the works of Goethe, Hesse, and Mann, as well as the now-banned novel by Remarque, All Quiet on the Western Front. She thought about her father for the 2 hours she spent collecting wood. The Allies had killed him, and now one of them was asleep in his cabin. She tried to mentally separate the stranger in the spare room from the men who'd dropped those bombs. She knew that the Nazis were the aggressors, but where was the justice in carpet-bombing civilians? Tens of thousands of innocents had already died, and the bombings were only intensifying. Then again, the enemy of her enemy was her friend. Despite what they'd done, the Allies had to have some kind of right on their side, and helping the man could afford her the chance to get some measure of revenge on the Nazis. Franco piled the wood inside the back door in crisscrossed open stacks to ensure minimum drying time. It would need to dry quickly, because it seemed that the winter weather, like the war itself, would only get worse before it got better. It was almost 11 in the morning when she went back to his bedroom. His eyes flicked open as she entered. They were murky, full of pain.
"How are you feeling?"
"I'm fine. I think I could use some more painkillers. I slept through the night, but I fear they might be wearing off now."
"Of course."
She had the prepared syringe in her hand as she went to the bed. He took his arm out from under the deep layer of blankets and presented it to her. He took the shot wordlessly and, without flinching, watched her push the needle into his arm. She brought him a light meal afterward and waited to speak until he'd finished it.
"I'm going to set the casts on your legs now. They'll give you a far better chance of making a satisfactory recovery, and it shouldn't be too painful while you're under the morphine."
His eyes were half closed, but he nodded.
"I'm going to have to wash your legs first. Then I'll put on the stockings."
His answer came in the form of another nod, his eyes closed. Franco warmed up some water and formed a good soapy lather in an old basin she'd found under the kitchen sink. She removed the primitive wooden splints and saved the wood for that night's fire. Franco washed the bottom half of his legs. She knew he probably needed an all-over sponge bath, but he would have to do that himself. That didn't seem proper here. She slipped on the stockings which ran from his knees to his ankles, and then wrapped the gauze bandages around them. As she mixed the plaster of Paris, words tumbled out of her mouth, partly to make him feel more comfortable, partly to hear a voice in the cold silence of the room.
I worked as a nurse for 3 years in Munich, at the university hospital. I saw a lot of broken legs. The injuries became worse as the war went on. I saw more and more young boys at the start of their lives, their whole futures ahead of them, with missing legs or arms or eyes. And then, it wasn't just soldiers anymore. It was women and children too, crushed in their own beds, or burned to a crisp by Allied bombs. Thousands and thousands of them. We hadn't enough room for the bodies in the morgue, not nearly. We had to lay them in the alley, pile them on top of one another.
She didn't speak for a few minutes as she dipped the gauze into the plaster mix and wrapped it around her leg. Did you ever work as a nurse around here?
No. I left for Munich after I graduated college. I took the opportunity to get out of Freiburg as soon as I could.
Why did you want to leave?
The sound of his voice startled her. His eyes were open, and he peered down at her.
I was young. I broke up with my boyfriend. I wanted a new start. I shirked my responsibilities to my family, and I left. I thought somehow that people in Munich might be different.
Were they?
Some, but not many.
She finished the first leg, leaving the plaster of Paris to set, and moved to the other.
It seems like I'm answering all the questions, when I'm the one who found you in the snow.
The man didn't answer.
Why did you bail out over the mountains? And what happened to the plane? I didn't hear anything. Why would you have bailed out there unless your plane was in trouble?
He took a few seconds to answer, and when he did, his voice was garbled and groggy.
I'm so sorry, Fräulein Gerber, but I cannot speak about my reasons for being here. That could compromise my mission and put brave soldiers on the front lines in danger.
Franco brought her eyes back down to the man's leg and bit her lip.
So then tell me something about yourself. Where are you from?
I'm from Karlshorst in Berlin. Do you know the city?
Not well. I went a couple of times when I was a girl with my League of German Girls group. We saw the sights, Unter den Linden, the Reichstag, the Stadtschloss.
It must have been exciting for a young girl to be at the center of the Reich like that.
She finished applying the gauze and began wetting the bandages in the plaster of Paris. The other leg was already drying. She ran her fingers over the surface of the cast. It was good.
Do you trust me?
She asked.
Of course. You're a loyal citizen of the Reich.
Why were you pointing a gun at me last night, then?
I wasn't sure where I was. I'm trained not to trust anyone. There is too much at stake. I see the error of my ways now. I see the kind of person you are. I admire anyone who'd go to such lengths as you have for a member of the Führer's armed forces. You're obviously someone who recognizes the value in every serviceman as we strive toward the final victory.
Franco almost laughed at the rhetoric the man was regurgitating, but managed not to. What was he really thinking?
Why didn't you ask me to contact anyone when I was in town? What about your wife and daughters? Do they even know you're alive?
That could compromise my mission. I need to ask that you not report to anyone that you've seen me, let alone the fact that I'm here.
Franco went to the window, stepping over the hole in the floorboards to get there. She threw back the curtain. The snow drifting down was just visible outside.
The snow is coming down again. The roads are going to be closed for days, weeks maybe. You're not going anywhere for a long time. You need to start trusting me. I could be the only friend you've got.
She picked up the basin, threw in the medical supplies, and stormed out of the bedroom, shutting the door behind her. A day passed, and then the next. The man lolled in morphine-induced delirium most of the time, and they spoke little. He emerged from his stupor on the third day. His pain was decreasing, and she had given him the last of his morphine shots that morning. It was 2 o'clock in the afternoon. His door was closed, but she imagined he could hear the radio programs she was listening to, none of them sanctioned by the National Socialists. If he was such a loyal subject, why didn't he object? What she doing was illegal, and enough to land her back in jail. She sat in the rocking chair, staring past her book. She tried to reason that he was who he said he was, but there was no getting past what he'd said in his sleep, what she'd heard. If he were Luftwaffe, even a spy, he would have asked her to get in contact with someone when she was in town. Even if what he said was true, and he was nervous about the Gestapo finding out about his mission, there should have been someone to call. Surely someone would have wanted to know if he was alive or dead. She put the book in her lap and rubbed her eyes in frustration. She placed several pieces of wood on the fire and watched for a few seconds as the flames engulfed them. It seemed like there was only one thing to do. He was awake and staring at the ceiling as she shoved the door open.
I need to tell you who I am. If you are who you say you are, then you'll likely be disgusted with me, and the next week or two that we're forced to spend together is going to be difficult. But I need to tell you. Perhaps then you'll open up to me.
Fräulein, there's no need for any loose talk. The less we know about each other, the better. I'm most grateful for all that you've done for me, but I can't let you compromise my mission.
What mission? What mission could a Luftwaffe airman possibly be on in the Black Forest Mountains in wintertime? I think you're here by mistake. I also believe that you're planning on trying to escape as soon as you're well again. That's your business, as long as it doesn't compromise my safety.
The man seemed shocked.
I would never do anything to hurt you. Not now that I know.
Do you have any idea why I was prying up the floorboards when you woke?
The man didn't answer, just looked on.
I was prying up the floorboards so I could hide you. So when the Gestapo come, which they inevitably will, you won't be lying in this bed.
Fräulein.
The Gestapo will come,
she repeated.
I ran into an old boyfriend of mine, who's a captain in the Gestapo. I didn't tell him that you were here, but he will come, particularly if they're already looking for you.
She leaned over the bed, both hands on the blanket.
I'll tell you who I am. And at the end of my story, if you still insist that you're a Luftwaffe airman, I'll look after you here for the next few days, and you can limp away when the weather clears, or else you can trust me, and I can help you.
The man didn't answer. His face was pale. He reached for the glass of water she'd left for him by the bed, and then looked at the hole in the floorboards. Silence filled the air.
I'm listening, he said.
Chapter 6. The arrival of another new chancellor in 1933 didn't seem momentous or noteworthy. There had been many, and little seemed to improve. Life was still hard. The worldwide depression was getting worse, and Germany appeared to have been stricken the hardest. The newspapers said that more than 15 million people, 20% of the population at the time, were living at subsistence level. This new man, this Hitler, was regarded as an upstart, a bad joke. His National Socialist Party had never achieved more than 37% of the vote, but the president had named him chancellor. Either way, the little Austrian corporal, as his political opponents had referred to him, could never last long. He and his brown-shirted rabble would be run out of power once the Republic had solved the infighting that had split the political powers apart. And besides, Hitler could not have really meant what he said in his speeches about his intention to tear the Republic apart and start again, or about his determination to avenge Germany's defeat in the World War, or about the Jews. A statement released to the papers by one of his spokesmen was largely ignored. "You must realize that what has happened in Germany is no ordinary change. Parliamentary and democratic times are past. A new era has begun." That same week, Frankel learned new words like lymphoma and metastasized, and saw her father cry for the first time. Freddy didn't understand, and his mother hugged him tight to her breast as he smiled that beautiful smile at her. She urged them to be brave. They had been through so much already. The future held only wonderful things. She would beat this cancer, and they would go on together. This was only the beginning of their lives. She wasn't even 40. It didn't matter what the doctor said. Faith would bring her through this, just as it had before. Just as it had when Freddy was born. And all of the times with him after. The cancer spread. Within weeks, Hitler had consolidated his power. The rights of free speech, press, and public assembly were abolished, and thus the German experiment with freedom and democracy ended. The German citizenry ceded absolute power to Hitler and his Nazis without so much as a whimper. The people didn't seem to feel oppressed by the new regime. They had no great faith in a dysfunctional and poorly designed democratic system. Kids began to wear Nazi armbands to school, and a new greeting of extending one's arm while saying "Heil Hitler" became a way of signaling loyalty to the party. The enthusiasm for a leadership that promised to place Germany back on its pedestal as one of the great nations of the world was contagious. Franke felt it. Almost every young person she knew felt it. It seemed like the German people were on the brink of something momentous and incredible. The support for the new National Socialist system came from all sides. Franke even noticed in the paper that an organization called the Association of German National Jews had voiced their support for the new Nazi regime. Franke saw the change almost immediately. A new ruling class was rising in cities and towns throughout Germany, and they were determined to make their presence known. Fortified by the party emblems in their buttonholes, the party membership cards in their pockets, and the swastikas on their sleeves, the previously obscure and unnoticed group began to assert themselves. Josef Donitz, a local grocer, began wearing a stormtrooper's uniform to work. Within weeks, he took over the local government without the formality or troubles of an election. The local fire chief, a lifetime friend of Franke's father, was elbowed out of his job by a junior fireman who was a known alcoholic and just happened to be a member of the party. Employees with party credentials spoke sharply to management, who began to listen respectfully. On every level of social and political life, the National Socialist Revolution manifested itself as a kind of seepage upward. The scum rising to the top. Franke's mother's determination pushed her past the timelines that the doctors laid out for her. For Sarah, 6 months to live meant,
"I'll see you next year to make you eat your words."
She wanted to spend her time outside, in the wondrous natural playground that seemed to stretch without boundary all around them. Franke's father, Thomas, bought the cabin in the mountains from his uncle Hermann, who had used it as a hunting lodge on his expeditions to shoot red deer and boar. Franke and her mother took to refurbishing the cabin, while Thomas worked on making it habitable in time for the warmer months. They spent most of that summer of 1933 up there, luxuriating in their time together. Franke grew to adore the sight of her family, sitting outside the cabin, as she returned with her friends from a hike in the mountains. On those warm summer nights, when the sun set behind the cabin, bathing the sky and trees in orange and red, When the smell of food on the stove mixed with the smoke from her father's pipe, it seemed like they'd found their own little piece of heaven. At the end of that glorious summer, when Sarah declared that she was going to see the same again the next year, Freddy wrapped loving arms around her. Franca and her father remained silent. Only Freddy seemed to believe it was possible, but time would prove him right. School changed. The Nazis were determined to be the party of youth. Commanding and controlling the allegiances of Germany's youth was a fundamental goal. The influence of the National Socialist Revolution was evident when Franca returned to Freiburg after that summer. The Nazi flag was hoisted in every classroom, and suddenly portraits of Adolf Hitler, the demigod at the head of the nation, appeared in place of crucifixes on the walls. The visage of a man she wouldn't have recognized a year before was now in every classroom. Books from the school library that were deemed subversive were taken out, piled high, and burned in the yard. Franco asked the librarian what they had taken, and was told that the local party members had removed any books, fact or fiction, that expressed a liberal idea, or suggested that the people themselves, rather than the Führer, should control their own destinies. New books on how the National Socialists had rescued Germany from the abyss of the Weimar Republic soon filled the gaps on the shelves. These new books were written in childish, simple language, but none of the teachers complained. They all became members of the National Socialist Teachers League. Eager to retain their jobs, and under pressure from the local government, they began championing the new ideas of the Nazis. Franca's favorite teacher, Herr Stiegel, was one of the few to protest the new ways, insisting that his lessons remain the same as they had been before the new government came to power. He lasted 2 weeks, and when Franca and some of the other students went to visit him at his old house outside town, they found it empty. They never saw him again. Nina Hess boasted afterward that she had informed on him to one of the local Nazi leaders. She was rewarded with a red sash, signifying her loyalty to the National Socialist regime, which she wore every day for the rest of the school year. No one wanted to be left behind, and Franca found herself swept up in the tidal wave of enthusiasm for the new dawn of the Aryan people. The Nazis had started using that term, Aryan, to describe the characteristics of ideal Germans. Franca was undoubtedly one of the super race they described. There was something gratifying in being told by the government that your blonde hair and blue eyes were perfect, that they made you the ideal German. She didn't know any other races, but the National Socialists insisted that she and her friends were blood-born into a master race, and that they were superior to all others. It felt good. She felt part of something important. The decision to join the League of German Girls came easily. All her friends already had. She was almost 17 then, and a bit old to be a member, but the promise of possibly being a group leader spurred her on. She didn't want to be left out, and besides, this was not a time to stand on the sidelines. This was a time for bold action. So she joined, despite the protestations of her parents, who seemed wary of the Nazi party at almost every level. Franca Gerber was the model of the magnificent youngster that Hitler prophesied would help Germany dominate the world. And she wasn't going to let any old-fashioned notions stand in her way. She was going to do her bit for the cause of the German people. Franca cherished her uniform of a white blouse with a loose black tie, pinned tight with the emblem of a swastika over a navy skirt. The girls of the League marched in much the same way as the boys in the Hitler Youth, who eyed them. They performed drills and did calisthenics and went on long hikes, often camping out under the stars, where they sang songs glorifying the Führer and longing for the day when they might provide strong sons for a future war effort. A sisterhood developed between the girls. Their common goals and focused efforts brought them together. It felt wonderful to be accepted, to be valued, to be superior. Daniel was a troop leader in the Hitler Youth, and led the drills as they jogged through town in swastika-emblazoned singlets, singing, "The old must perish, the weak must decay." Truly, they were the finest of German youth, slim and lithe, as fast as greyhounds, and as hard as Krupp steel, just as Hitler himself had demanded. And Daniel was the finest of them all, and directed the younger members with a strict but fair countenance. With flushed cheeks, all the girls talked about him and whispered behind their hands as he strode past. He and Franka came together like magnets. All that was strong and beautiful about the new Germany encapsulated between them. His father, who had been unemployed before the National Socialist Revolution, was now a leading member of the local council. Franka never saw him without his Nazi pin on his chest, or the Nazi armband adorning his bicep. His son was the realization of his dreams, the promise of a new and better life for the Aryan race. Daniel was stern with his recruits, but reserved a tenderness that he seemed to show only her. He was ambitious and forward-looking, serious and determined. He was the perfect boyfriend for the exciting times she was living through. She found herself drawn in deeper and deeper. It was the end of school, just before graduation, when she took him home to meet her parents for the first time. Daniel was respectful and polite. He wore his Hitler Youth Leader's uniform to dinner and gave the Nazi salute as Franka's father opened the door to him. Franka's mother stepped forward, doing her best to smile as he greeted her. They made their way to the table, and Franka sat down next to him. Freddy sat in his usual spot at the end of the table. Daniel greeted him with a nod. He wasn't shy toward her parents, however, and spoke of his plans to join the newly formed Gestapo, the elite police force, and about the need to protect the revolution from spies and malingerers. That was the first time Franka ever heard the phrase, "enemies of the state." Her parents retained their polite demeanor, but she saw them glancing toward one another during the meal through slit eyes, could feel their judgment. She knew what was coming after he left. Franka's father carried Freddy up to bed. Her mother waited until he got back downstairs before she sat Franka down. She put a pale hand on Franka's leg. She looked tired all the time now, her beauty dulled by the unseen enemy within her. Her bloodshot eyes were earnest, but calm.
"How serious is it with Daniel? I know you've been seeing each other a while." "I love him, Mother. You were only a little older than I am now when you met Father."
Thomas sat down, rubbing his eyes.
"I was 22, your mother 19. You're just 17 and still in school. We're wondering if Daniel is a distraction to your studies. You're so involved with this League of German Girls now, it seems that you're spending all your free time with them."
"I love my troop. I'm part of something. You don't know anything about what's going on in this country. You're stuck in the old world of the Kaiser and the Weimar idiots who ran Germany into the ground."
"The old world?"
Sarah said.
"Who taught you these things?"
Franka fought back the sympathetic emotions telling her to comfort her mother. That wouldn't have been the patriotic thing to do. This was an opportunity to convince her parents that every German had a duty to help with the National Socialist Revolution.
"We're worried about you,"
her mother said.
"Worried about what? I have the comradeship of the other girls in the League. Even my teachers all express the glory of the new movement. Everyone seems to, but you."
"So, tell me about your glorious revolution," Thomas said, his voice low.
"You only have to look at the statistics in the newspaper. Hitler is ending the Depression. Unemployment is dropping to levels no one could have dreamed of before the Führer swept to power. The German workman is productive once again. Surely that is an achievement worth